Good afternoon. Welcome again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. There's been some important advances in the understanding of the structure and function of the brain and our mind, and these have been plentiful recently, so I thought it seemed like an appropriate time to stop and take a breath and maybe review a little bit about what we've learned. And when I thought about that a little bit further, I could think of no one better than this week's guest, Dr. Ginger Campbell. Dr. Campbell is the producer and host of Brain Science Podcast. This is a very popular podcast that has won some awards on iTunes, has had more than 2 million downloads of her podcast. She has a big interest in medicine, brain, consciousness, and something that has appealed to me as I've gotten older, and that's the history of science and ideas. She started her podcast in 2006. If you want to, and what our topics would be today, we've kind of discussed beforehand that we'd like to limit the discussion to brain plasticity, which we'll talk about a little bit, how we might maintain brain health, especially as we age, cognitive enhancement, the use of perhaps medications or drugs to improve our thinking and ability, and where that might be appropriate and ethical, and maybe where it's not ethical. Embodied cognition, which we'll define and describe, and also a little bit about the importance of what we're learning of how our unconscious mind guides a lot of decisions and judgments, and has led Dr. Campbell to write her own book, which we'll have her discuss with you. To reach us during the next hour or so with your questions and comments, you can call our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email us during this next hour at line1@alaskapublic.org. And I also failed to mention, I think we could probably, if we have the time, twist your arm to answer any questions you might have about new developments in brain science and understanding the mind. Ginger, welcome back to Line One.
Thanks, Thad. It's great to be back.
I'm going to take one of those editorial prerogatives and just ask our listeners to hang in there for a second, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about podcasting and I'm always interested in what's driving you in particular. You do an extremely good job of producing this podcast on your own, and you have transcripts produced, which many of the podcasts don't. So what's driving you to do this?
Well, my own curiosity drives me to read about the brain, but I love to share what I've learned with others, and podcasting is just a great outlet for that. As a physician, my favorite thing probably is teaching my patients and talking with my patients, and podcasting is kind of an outgrowth of that. It's surprised me how many people around the world my podcasts have touched. As a physician, that I think is the thing that surprised me the most. Sometimes I feel like my podcast makes more of an impact than I do as a doctor. I'm not sure if that's a good thing, but it does keep me going when I'm tempted to stop.
Yeah, it's certainly it's a reason that I'm involved. I love teaching education, and you sure can reach a broader audience in. It's almost like the milieu is better for educating than in a patient interview or talking with a patient at the time. There's so many other things that might be blocking reception and transmission of information in those meetings, whereas that's not true with this podcasting.
That's true. I mean, the people who listen to my podcast are doing it of their own free will.
You bet.
And they usually have come looking for what I'm doing, and that, rather than, you know, sometimes as an ER doc, they are coming in. They unfortunately often have it in their mind. What they want is not necessarily the same thing as what I think they need. So that can lead to conflict, obviously.
All right. Well, Dr. Campbell has interviewed lots of experts and physicians and researchers and writers in this area. So let's jump in and talk about, as we said, let's talk about brain plasticity at the beginning and perhaps define that and maybe the consequences of our increasing understanding of it.
Okay, well, brain plasticity, to put it simply, is just the discovery that our brain continues to change and grow, even make new neurons or new brain cells throughout our lifetime. We used to think this was something that was done by the time we were born, and we now know that that's not true. This has a lot of important implications, for example, in education for people of all ages. Brain fitness, which you mentioned, only becomes a meaningful concept if we know that our brains are plastic. Aging, knowing that our brains are plastic means there's something we can do to combat, you might say, the problems of aging. And then rehabilitation, people who have strokes and brain injuries, there's new hope for them because of these discoveries about brain plasticity. So that's why I think it's probably the single most exciting field.
Why did it take us so long to recognize that it wasn't just in early infancy that we were laying down new neurons? And in my line of work as a pediatrician, I was realizing we were pruning those things away that may not be used. But was it just the technology that limited our understanding of this?
Well, I guess the technology probably was the reason why the earliest recognized neuroscientists about 100 years ago, and I cannot pronounce the guy who drew all the wonderful pictures of neurons and got the Nobel Prize for it, but he sort of told everybody that that was the case, and it became something of a dogma. Doctors don't like to admit that medicine has its own dogmas, but it does, and I'm sure you remember being told in medical school that you couldn't make any new neurons. And so doctors and scientists are human, and once we believe a certain thing, we tend to only see the evidence that supports what we already believe. So I think that there were several decades in which there was evidence of brain plasticity that, was kind of ignored. Mm-hmm. And then finally somebody got some evidence that couldn't be ignored, and then, of course, everyone goes back and says, oh, here's that other evidence that suggested this, and then it becomes like, oh, this is obvious. Why didn't we see it before? Mm-hmm. I think this story, it repeats itself often in the history of science.
Sure. I mean, and if you think back before we realized that the brain was plastic, and you might ask yourself, if the aging brain is truly plastic, if it's repairing itself or changing with time and experience, then why does it age in the first place? But then when you really stop thinking about that question, you realize that there's no reason why, just because it ages, it couldn't be still adapting to what it's experiencing.
I mean, we know we can continue to learn new things. Everyone knows that. So that it's true that it gets harder to learn new things, and that's a reality, but that doesn't mean we can't. And I'm now telling people we can no longer say, I'm too old to learn XYZ, because it just isn't true. It might be harder, but actually it turns out the fact that it's harder is one of the things that makes it good for our brains. If it's easy, it's not going to be stimulating your brain to grow. It's like exercise. If the only exercise you do is the same thing every day, your level of conditioning isn't going to improve either. Brain plasticity means that we should now start thinking about our brain the same way we think about our muscles in terms of how we take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Which leads to this idea of what we can do to keep that going as we get older. But we can come back to that a little bit. I want to stay on the basic aspect of what the neurons are doing for a second, if you don't mind. And I read something recently that struck me as another analogy, and analogies are dangerous, but we're learning how different genes in our genome work back and forth and can work with different other genes at different times and actually seem to jump around. And now it seems to me, if I'm understanding some of the neurology, the neurosciences now, is that I always thought that neurons just worked with another neuron, but they may actually work with different neurons at different times. Is that true also? It's not just a one-to-one correlation all the time.
Yes, it's actually, the evidence for that is becoming pretty overwhelming, that what really makes things happen is networks of neurons. Mm-hmm. And that means that one neuron might at one point be part of a network to do one thing, and then at another time a network to do another. This is kind of in the early emphases of being able to study, because we can't really yet study the brain at the true neuronal level during something as complex as the kinds of things we're interested in. But we do know that that's why the Human Connectome Project, which is about figuring out how the neurons are connected, is coming to the fore, because it looks like, well, it's like being a person in a crowd. A single person doesn't have much of a voice, but a bunch of people together can have a big voice, and that's the way neurons appear to work.
You know, that when you said network, it made me understand something I was going to talk about a little bit later. But let me do it now. I was preparing for the program. I was looking at some of the programs you had done before, and when you did the program on Slights of Mind, I wrote down that there was a take-home point: is that writing down reasons for important decisions and focus on each of them individually is a good idea, since when we consider the logical reasons, we at that point all suppress the emotional reasons, so that when we take the time to write something down, we separate logic from emotional things, which helps us maybe make decisions better. And I was in the hospital, and a nurse started talking to me about her anxiety about taking tests. And I said, you know, I've read that a good way, and I actually have suggested this to people, to handle anxiety, particularly sleep anxiety, is to take about 5 minutes before you go to sleep and write down on a piece of paper what you're going to be worried about, and that it may also work for other anxieties. And then I said, and what that does is it takes the emotion out of it. I had never said that before. I never thought that that's the way that worked. I always wondered how in the world that worked. So it's like, you know, how did my mind bring those two ideas together? And it makes sense. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But there's to me, a network working in putting stuff together in ways that I never would have thought, and here I spit out a different idea.
Yeah, that makes me think of the famous writer, and I can't think of who it was right this minute, who said he didn't know what he thought until he wrote it down. You remember that saying? I'm paraphrasing.
It's truly amazing how our mind can come together with all these different ideas and create new thoughts. Well, how does all this relate? This plasticity issue relate to learning in particular? I think that's something that we've talked about on the program with others. Be specific about that.
Well, obviously, without plasticity, we would not be able to learn. Mm-hmm. Because learning implies making new connections between neurons. So I think they're just fundamentally interconnected. That's the thing to me that makes it a little odd that we thought our brains weren't plastic, because we've always taken learning for granted. I mean, we know that if you want to learn a new skill, you've got to break it down, practice it a lot until it finally becomes automatic, which we'll come back to that later. But we've always done that even before we understood why it worked.
And if I understand it right, is we learn and we do something more and more repetitively, we actually increase the amount of myelin that promotes more rapid transmission and more accuracy of transmission of that information over time.
Yeah, that's a part of what happens.
Which I use, again, when I'm talking to kids or parents about, if you're going to teach kids things, you want them to see good behaviors, a loving parents, that you're going to be there, because they're also learning how people care about them, how people interact. It's not just the physical things we think about, learning how to ride a bicycle or something like that.
Right, and you were talking about the role of emotions in decision-making. Mm-hmm. A lot of that stuff that's the kind of stuff you learn from your parents. You learn, you know, like you might get the message that it's okay to fail, because as long as you did your best and you learned, it was fine. But if you had a parent who every time you failed told you you were no good, then you become afraid, you know, to try things at the edge. That's an emotional thing. And then later you might be an adult who never wants to try anything new. You don't really remember how you got there.
Right, right. So all of this is learned, and there's a physical component to it, which brings up the other issue, is that our brain is very good at learning, but not so good at unlearning. And that's where the corollary of what we were talking about earlier. Now you've learned these kinds of behaviors or these kinds of ways to do things, and it's those are probably always there, but now you got to set up a new circuit, so to speak.
Yeah, several years ago when I interviewed Norman Deutsch, who's well known for his wonderful book, The Brain That Changes Itself, he had a great illustration that stuck with me. He says, it's like if you go skiing and, you know, you ski on fresh snow and you set down a new, you know, groove in the snow. But if a bunch of people ski down that same spot, then there's a rut and it's hard to get out of that rut. When you come down, now when you come down the slope, you're going to have a tendency to just go in that rut. He called that the dark side of plasticity.
But the other, I guess another way to think about the plasticity is that you can get out of that rut. You can develop a new track.
You can. It just is not as easy as...
And the longer...
Maybe good ones to begin with, yeah.
The longer it's been going on, the harder it is to change. Is that that's still fair to say?
Yeah. And I saw a book that I didn't cover that I think it's called Habit. Mm-hmm. I'll send you a link to it, but there's some good research on how you can be successful at changing old habits. It requires understanding a little bit more about what's going on in the brain. But that's somebody you might want to interview. I'll have to get you that information.
Yeah, that would be interesting, and that also gets to some of this performance anxiety, and in a sense, I think of that as a habit that's been developed under certain situations. And so if we're going to learn how to change some of these bad habits, in quotes, that we all develop, and the way we think or the way we put the information together and so forth, we need to know that there are ways to get out of that old track that we found when we were skiing, huh?
Yeah, that's why the sports psychologists make so much money on helping the professional athlete.
All right. But it works, is what you're saying. There's evidence that we can create these new ways of doing things.
Now, we are talking about the doing things the hard way, okay? So I'm going to just jump to the cognitive enhancement issue.
Okay.
You know, it might seem that it would be easier just to take a pill. And I know a lot of kids now are taking things like Adderall in college that they don't have any, you know, medical necessity for. And this really concerns me, not so much as whether or not it's ethical. That's an issue that concerns many people. And I don't know why that's not my big focus, but what worries me personally is I don't want to take this stuff because I don't know what it's going to do to my brain. You know, none of these drugs have been around long enough to know what their long-term consequences are. And we do know that our brain has a very complex and fragile chemistry. You know, I'm an ER doctor. There's a drug I could take that supposedly would make it easier for me not to, you know, be sleepy when I have to work long hours. But I don't want to take it because, you know, I want to leave my brain chemistry alone. That's just my particular bias on the subject.
Well, yeah, you're not alone. July 2nd of this year, and one of the bits of information I got crossing my desk, it's clear that the three neurologic societies in the U.S. have come out and argue that prescribing stimulant medications to augment cognitive or affective function in healthy children and adolescents is not justifiable. And they put down some ethical issues, some developmental issues, social and legal issues, and even some professional issues. So they give a huge amount of argument in favor of that way of approaching this problem.
And just to do an example, you know, there's a lot of people, I don't know what age you are, but for my age, I'm in my 50s, there's a lot of people who, you know, used marijuana back when they were younger who are now, and I'm not talking just a little bit, who are now suffering some consequences that weren't expected. So that's, of course, that was illegal, but it's just a good example of how you can have consequences that aren't the ones you were you were aiming for.
We did get an email along this same line, and you've addressed some of these issues already, but I think I ought to read the email and let you make some comments. And it comes from a listener who says, many kids are taking drugs for attention deficit disorder, like Adderall and Concerta, to allow them to focus better in school situations. Now we hear that perhaps these drugs are being prescribed more for school performance than for ADHD or ADD. Is there anything wrong with that? And are there long-term issues using these drugs? And what about personality shifts from kids that are on these drugs versus off the drugs? And so that addresses very specifically what you were commenting on.
Yeah, and I want to make it clear that I am not saying that kids that need the drugs shouldn't get them. I'm not in a position to judge whether they are being overprescribed for alleged ADHD or not.
Right.
But assuming that they are, everybody I've talked to who works in this field agrees that there's a place for the drugs in people that really need them. I'm saying, as I said before, if your brain works good, mm-hmm. you know, why do you want to take the chance of screwing it up?
Right, right.
And usually the real reason, there could be the reason of, you know, you're under a lot of pressure to make great grades, but then there's always that temptation of, if I had the magic pill, I could get there easy, I could get there faster, right. I wouldn't have to work as hard.
Right. As a pediatrician, there's a little bit, it gets difficult for me. So I definitely see, I agree with everything you're saying, by the way, and I definitely see kids who benefit dramatically. I mean, it's like night and day with stimulant medications. But as they grow, some of them learn some compensatory ways to study or not be distracted and be effective. But then they may say, you know, I certainly find myself wanting to take that medication in college because it does allow me to focus and stay on task for just doing my homework. So I'll only do it when I'm studying for a test, for example. Now you've got a kid who clearly had an attention deficit disorder, as best we can tell, is adapted to some degree to that in ways without medication, but still finds that really, when they need it, they want to take that medication. And is that the same thing, you know, as using it to enhance performance? It gets tough for me in this situation.
Right, right. I have a relatively new book that I'm looking at about ADHD. I can't think of the name of it right off the top of my head. It's by Thomas Brown. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And I've just started reading it, but he's talking about how it's not unusual, especially as you get grown, that people are in a situation where they get, you know, pushed to where they have trouble facing. So I think that unless they're in one of those kinds of stressful situations, and so I think that perhaps that would fall in that category for those kinds of kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I would look at that.
Right, right.
But I can see, yeah, that does start to get into the gray zone. But then, yeah, that's the reality of life. Most of the life is actually in the gray zone, right?
Right, right. There's one other comment on this. Statement from these the Child Neurology Association, American Academy of Neurology, that struck me as a way I wouldn't have thought of the problems with the medications other than it just over-medicalizes our society and everything. But this is a comment that was written about in developmental issues, and it says, we need to protect the authenticity in childhood and adolescence. That is, the capacity of children and adolescents to develop their own unique individuality and achieve self-fulfillment through life. And although neuroenhancement may promote authenticity, drugs can alter the personality and constrain individuals from living authentically. I thought that was an interesting comment. I hadn't thought about that aspect of using these medications in ways that...
I don't know. Yeah, that's... I don't know.
We're kind of making them not who they otherwise would be is, I guess, how I think about that. And that's... I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Interesting comment. What about this issue, if we don't mind getting back to brain health and staying healthy? What are the things that we should have our listeners know that we're learning about that over time?
Well, the basic principle is that you need to do things that are mentally challenging. That means learning new things rather than working, you know, like if you're a crossword puzzle worker, you know, the 100th crossword puzzle is probably not as beneficial to your brain as the first 10. exercise, we know the evidence is overwhelming that exercise is very important to brain health. When it comes to diet, there's no clear-cut evidence that any particular, you know, supplement is going to help you. There is some evidence that, you know, you need some omega-3 fatty acids in your diet, but you need those for the rest of your body too. So when it comes to diet, I usually just say you need to eat what's good for your body and eat what's good for your heart. If it's good for your heart, it's going to be good for your brain, because your brain depends on blood supply, which obviously your heart and your circulation is essential to. So I don't think, I'm not a big into trying to discover brain foods. Things like, for example, ginkgo biloba, which has been a popular one for years, has got overwhelming evidence that it does not work. See. As far as the computer cognitive training things, there's two issues there. A lot of the stuff that's being sold has not been validated or tested in any way to see whether or not it actually does anything. And the ones that have been, the biggest problem has been what's called transferability. That is, you can definitely get better at something on a computer, but whether or not that transfers into a real-life skill has proven to be difficult, although they seem to be making some progress on that. And ironically, video games, you know, some video games are showing to be beneficial in older people, which is really kind of funny. Right. Not really surprising if you've ever actually played a video game, but I think that that's startling to people who bought into the old video games are bad for you mythology. That's a good overview, I hope.
Yeah, it's almost like the old wag that it's, you know, a little bit is good, but focusing. So if you just do video games all day long, it's what are you not doing while you're playing the video games? But there are some benefits from, you know, eye-hand coordination. It'd be one of the first things I would think of from some of these games.
Well, for older people, one of the biggest issues has to do with awareness of surroundings, especially when driving. Dr. Michael Merznick told me that his research has shown that as people get older, when they're driving, their eye movements are more centered and right in front of them, and they don't look around the way younger drivers do. And so they've developed a program. He has a company called Posit Science. They've developed a program for driving for older people that's supposed to encourage them to look, you know, to look at things to the periphery. And when you play a video game, especially a shooting video game, you have to do this exact same thing. You have to look all over the screen and spot, you know, the bad guys before they shoot you. It's sort of similar to that idea. So from that point of view, I can see how some kind of video games would be more helpful. In fact, I think, well, my husband is retired military, so we have the USAA insurance. And we just got an email like last week telling us we could do this driving program. I think it's called Drive Sharp. I can't remember the exact name. For free. So USAA is actually paying for any of its members over the age of 55 to do this program for free. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I have to look for that in my email, since I used USAA also.
Yeah, I've already done the first part of it. It's very similar to some of their other programs. They have something called Brain HQ now that you can get. That's like on the on the browser, but you can also do it on your iPad. And the exercises in the driving program are very similar. The reason I mention Posit Science is because they actually do have research being done on their programs. They're trying to make it scientifically valid. If you want to find information about which ones of these programs have and have not been tested, the Sharp Brains website is the place to go, because they try to keep track of all the research and, you know, what has scientific validity and what doesn't. Because there's an awful lot of people jumping on this bandwagon to try to make money selling, you know, cognitive training to people. So you really have to be in a state of buyer beware.
We need to take our break, and then I'm going to tease our listeners by saying when we come back, we want to talk about another food, I guess I can call it a food, that you didn't mention related to brain health, and that's alcohol. And we'll see what your thoughts are. So remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Or you can just go to alaskapublic.org and you can see a link to Dr. Campbell's podcast, Brain Science. We will be right back. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Ginger Campbell. She's been a host and producer of the Brain Science podcast since 2006, and we're addressing some newer information that we have learned through science about how the brain works, how the mind might be defined and how it works, as well as some of the structural issues. We've talked about brain plasticity. We've talked about how we maintain some brain health over time, what works and what does not work. We've mentioned a little bit about something called cognitive enhancement. We're going to talk about embodied cognition and define that for you shortly, I think, and talk about our unconscious mind and how it can lead us to decisions that we never really understood things were going on in our mind that might be doing that shortly. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. You can email us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. And always remember, you can re-listen to the program tonight locally as a taped broadcast between 9 and 10 p.m., and we can't take any phone calls or emails during that time. And also, you can go to alaskapublic.org and listen to this program at any time and any of our programs that are now archived on alaskapublic.org. So when you were talking about food enhancement, you mentioned exercise as a good way to do things, that the evidence for brain, for foods promoting brain healthy brain activity was not good. And then we hear things about alcohol that is good and bad. Can you tell us where we really are about alcohol and maintaining good brain function?
Well, yeah, alcohol's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, there is evidence that very moderate intakes of alcohol might be beneficial to the cardiovascular system, which then in turn could be beneficial to the brain. There seems to be ample evidence that excessive alcohol is bad. The one question is, well, where's the line between excessive and moderate? I got a news release from Western Carolina University recently, that there's an article on PLOS about the fact that they did a study that showed that acute alcohol doesn't impair our ability to make automatic judgments, but it impairs ones that are controlled. And that makes sense. You know that people, when they get drunk, tend to make bad decisions. You know, they still can walk and do, unless they're really drunk, but, you know, they'll do impulsive things. It's like, you know, the veto circuits get turned off. So in terms of decision-making, alcohol, you know, everyone that's ever tried it knows that can cause problems. Personally, I don't know what the answer is. As I get older, I'm asking myself, honestly, I'm asking myself, is there an age? I consider myself a person that drinks moderate alcohol, wine, now and then. And I wonder, you know, is there an age at which I should consider stopping? Or is it something that's actually beneficial that I should continue? I honestly do not know the answer. I do know that getting drunk is bad for you, and obviously being an alcoholic is bad for you, all parts of your body. But as far as is there a healthy amount, you know, I don't. The evidence is it's hard to sort out. That's why all our medical organizations are, you know, hemming and hawing about what we should tell our patients. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, we don't like the I don't know answer. I don't know.
Yeah, no. And I think that's fair. And so many of us think we know all the answers, and we're going to get into that maybe in a second also. But sometimes the best answer is we don't have all the facts quite yet, and you have to make your best judgment. But to clarify this, because I know there's people listening who are absolutely asking themselves, like I am, what can I be doing to keep my mind functioning as well as I can as I age? So I'm going to ask you the question. If you were allowed just one thing to do to maintain your brain health as you age, what would that be, knowing what you know?
Exercise every day.
Yeah. I had a feeling you were going to say that. I think that.
And preferably, if I've only got one thing, I want that exercise to be something that's also mentally stimulating, not something boring like, walking on a treadmill.
Ah, good point. Expand on what you're saying there.
Well, if the exercise you do is something mentally stimulating, then you're going to be sort of, you know, I might say, killing two birds with one stone, because you also are going to get some actual mental stimulation at the same time as you're getting your physical exercise. So, for example, Tai Chi, which is a form of exercise practiced in China by many older people, is actually quite mentally stimulating, because you have to keep track of where you are in the form, and it may not be rapidly done, but it requires thought as you go along. You don't do it mindlessly. If you play tennis, which is a great sport because you can play it against other people of whatever age you happen to be, you know, you've got to be thinking about strategy and what you're going to do next and all at the same time as you're physically exerting. So those would be two examples. Mm-hmm. Even golf, although I hate golf because it's so slow, I'm not really sure golf quite qualifies as exercise unless you actually walk the course, which is hard to do in the States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you qualified that, because I was going to really jump on you there. I'm a big golfer. It's about my only exercise, but I walk all the time. so when you were going to address golf, I was going to, oh, wait a minute. The other thing is about I think it's a great comment about the stimulating and not doing this something, because it also is more likely you're going to keep doing it if you're stimulated in some way.
And that's the thing I tell my listeners when they come to this whole issue of the computer programs for cognitive training. Mm-hmm. If that's something you really enjoy, fine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that stuff is really boring. And instead, you could be learning, you know, a foreign language or learning to play that musical instrument that you always, those are the two favorite ones that scientists have studied. Learning a new language or learning a musical instrument or any new skill that's something you've always wanted to do would probably have, you know, be, you're more likely to stick to it than, you know, some potentially boring exercises on the computer. That's one thing that the video games have going for them, and why they're trying to figure out how to, great video games know how to put the player right on the edge of challenge, where it's just hard enough, but the person doesn't give up. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you see your kids will stay at the video games, and they'll get kicked. You know, and they'll stick to it. And if we could figure out to make how to tap into that with education, there's a whole field of research on that now.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on and discuss embodied cognition. Define for listeners in our language what you're talking about when, because you seem to really enjoy talking about embodied cognition on your program.
Yeah, and I can see that we're getting pretty late on time, so I'm going to give you a little spiel on this so that we can be sure to hit the key ideas. Embodied cognition basically just refers to the fact that the human mind, or all minds for that matter, are a product of a brain that's within a specific body that's interacting with the world, i.e. our mind is embodied, it's in the body. And the reason that this area fascinates me so much is that it deeply impacts how we understand our minds. There are those outside of science that resist the trend toward using the term mind and brain interchangeably, whereas many scientists are intent on banishing what's known as dualism and the various mystical notions of the mind that treat it like it's something utterly separate and independent from the brain. The evidence is growing, and it's overwhelming, that the brain generates the mind, but it's not doing it in isolation, because the brain gets inputs, all of its inputs, from the body, which in turn has to interact with the world. So to me, the idea of embodiment captures that, the sense that there is more to the mind than an isolated brain, but it also keeps the whole process of mind grounded in the physical reality of our brain and the world around us.
Give us some concrete examples, or one at least, of what you're talking about and how this is important.
Okay, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is the difference between my world and my dog's world. When I take my dogs for a walk, you know, what fascinates them about the neighborhood is smelling stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because their interaction with the world is largely olfactory, and that's true for most mammals, whereas we're sight-oriented. So the world we experience as humans, assuming we have eyesight, is very colored by the fact that we have the kind of vision that we have. A bat, on the other hand, you know, uses sonar. Its world is entirely different from us. We all have, all three of these animals have brains that create, it depends upon your definition of mind, create a mind. But it's totally different based on how they interact with the world and the particular bodies that they have.
Okay.
Is that what you meant?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. All right. Does it?
And as people goes, one of our problems is that because we tend to think everyone else sees the world exactly like we do. You know, we're not really
right.
Very good at even though people are better at putting ourselves in positions of others than we think other animals are. It's still hard because the world we experience is, our tendency is to think that's the same world everyone has. Leads to a lot of misunderstandings.
Yeah. Is that in a sense saying the same thing as what we see and what we think and how we envision things is dependent on
what we expect to be seeing also, or is that slightly different than what you're talking about?
Well, that would definitely be slightly different, but
gotcha.
Obviously
gotcha.
Related. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So that gets into this whole issue of placebo effects and how do we know what's really real in science, for example.
Yeah, we didn't leave ourselves time to talk
right.
really about placebos today,
right.
did we?
No, that's a good one. Maybe next time. All right. Well, let's also, I want to give you time to talk about a book you've written. You've journeyed into that aspect of all of this, and the title of your book is called Are You Sure? If you want to tell us about it and what led you to write this book.
Okay. My book is called Are You Sure? The Unconscious Origins of Certainty. And it's actually based on two episodes of the Brain Science Podcast that feature Dr. Robert Burton and his book, which was called On Being Certain, Believing You're Right Even When You're Not. And the focus of this is the fact that we have all experienced the feeling of certainty. Sometimes we will call it our intuition or gut reaction or something similar to that. But the evidence is that this does not come from the part of our brain that we actually have conscious access to, that it comes from a part of our brain that we don't have conscious access to. In fact, Dr. Burton has recently published another book called The Skeptical Guide to the Mind that brings us into more other areas about what our brain does. So Are You Sure is just an introduction to the idea that much more of what our brain does is beyond our conscious awareness than we had previously supposed, and what the implications of that are.
That, to me, is really, really interesting. To me, it gets into some of the writings that Daniel Kahneman's done called Thinking Fast and Slow, mm-hmm. and how we make decisions and form judgments, and how psychologists can really tell that we have biases that are unconscious that affect these decisions. It makes me think about also this fallibility of memory a little bit, of how we have these judgments or thoughts about the way things were and how that often turns out not to be true on close study.
Yeah. Dr. Burton made me aware of the famous study of the Challenger disaster, where they had people write down right at the time of the disaster where they were and what they were doing, and came back a couple years later and talked to them. And only about 25% of them had the same recollections that they had at the time. There was actually one guy that they showed what he had written down, and he said, "I know that's what I wrote, but that's not what happened."
Yeah.
Yeah, and Elizabeth Loftus, of course, is the leading expert in this field, and been very important in debunking the whole repressed memory movement. And then there's the talk about other episodes, just the whole issue of eyewitness testimony, the
right.
fact that
right.
our memories are so malleable. They're not videotapes.
Mm-hmm. Was it David Eagleman that had written a lot about how this gets involved in some of the legal aspects of stuff? He gets into this consciousness and implications, and are we in as much control as we think we are, and da-da-da, where that gets going, it gets pretty deep pretty quick.
Yeah, I kind of like Antonio Damasio's take on it. He points out that personal responsibility is not inside the brain. It's something that happens between people. And the other thing is it's a learned skill. If we were spending more time on the mm-hmm. unconscious, I would say that, there's stuff in the a lot of what we would now call unconscious was previously conscious. Whenever you learn a skill, and you get it to the point where it's automatic, then it becomes, to a certain extent, unconscious. So I think that an idea I would really like to leave people with is that one of the things that our new appreciation of the role of unconscious processes is this unconscious that we're now talking about, it is not the unconscious of Freud and Jung, okay. It's not a place where there's a bunch of repressed memories and, you know, secret drives to have sex with everything. That's not what we're talking about. It's true that our decisions are going to be influenced by things we don't remember anymore, like, you know, emotional, you know, components and things. But a lot of what's going on is stuff that we've made automatic through practice. And that's why teaching our children, you know, how to get along with others, what you might call morality, matters, because that then becomes the unconscious, you know, behavior. So I think the real question is, should people be excused because they failed to learn to act responsibly? In that case, I think we have to ask, did they have the ability to learn right and wrong? And if they couldn't learn it, then maybe they should be excused. But, you know, if they actually, you know, a lot of sociopaths know right and wrong. They don't care. Now, that's a whole different issue.
Right. You know, Ginger,
morality is a mental skill.
It's a learned skill.
And it's a learned mental skill.
Right. Which gets us back to the beginning here on brain plasticity and the importance of what children are learning early, which I didn't maybe do as good a job as I would have liked, to how important that early critical several years of life are and how we learn what you're saying is morality and ethics, not just how to learn how to ride a bike and how to talk. It's what's happening in those early formative years that can have consequences unconsciously for the rest of our lives. That's really the big lesson here, if I'm not overstating it.
Yes, but at the same time, I think that if we, you know, for people that are working with troubled children who maybe got off to a bad start, they need to realize that plasticity always often means that that those kids still have a chance. Those kids can change, but they're just like we are as grown-ups. It's going to still be harder than them if they started out in the right groove.
Right. I've dominated the questions here. I want to say that we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left, and our local phone number, for those of you who might want to try to ease in on our conversation, 550-8433, 550-8433, or line1@alaskapublic.org. Ginger, just off the topic, just briefly, something somebody said on one of your podcasts, and I don't remember who it was, is they were looking about MRIs and how so much of what our knowledge now is being dependent on how we believe the validity of functional MRIs, those things where we're seeing the brain working and we're seeing it in action while we're doing certain things to someone. And they bring the point up that there's not been a lot of work done on the reproducibility of these techniques, which I think is an important issue. Do you remember that issue?
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about William Utall's work, and he actually has a new book out now that's all about the whole problem of using the meta-analysis in this area. Sure. But I think that, fortunately, this is being somewhat, first of all, the problem, I think, is being recognized, although there's so much financial incentive to put fMRIs in every study that anyone does. But I think that the work toward studying the connectivity of the brain is shedding light on what we're really looking at. If you happen to look at places that light up, there's so many ways that can be changed by just how you set the settings. And in the end, it's probably going to turn out that most parts of the brain are involved in most everything. Right. And what really matters is who's talking to who at any particular time, parts of the brain-wise, I mean.
Mm-hmm. I give a talk on the importance of science and how science can go wrong and how it has gone wrong. And there's a famous paper that was presented. I can't remember where it was presented, but it had to do with some guys were working with some fish, and they noticed that the fish, it was salmon, if they saw a picture on the wall, they noticed that on their MRI scanners, part of their brain would light up. And so they got to looking at this, and they finally published the information. The problem was these were dead fish, and the whole issue was how they manipulated the gain on the MRI scan, which is a good example of, you know, you better know what you're doing with your equipment. It's just another way we can get led astray in science.
Yeah, I mean, like, in the case of the fMRI, if you say you have to decide what's your criteria for when the pictures are arbitrary. They're generated from the numbers, and they have to pick a number that they say, oh, well, if it's past this number, we're going to make it orange, for example. Okay, well, depending on what you make that number, the whole brain could light up or just one little spot, right?
Yep.
So it's...
Yep.
It's like the worst possible example of how you can prove anything with statistics.
Right.
I'm sure you've heard that saying.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's not just the evidence is I guess something I keep finding myself. It's how good is the evidence, and that's what we're learning. And as we move along with science, there's a lot of evidence out there, but a lot of that evidence is not very good.
Yeah, and then there's the whole issue of, because we're now getting these very large, complex sets of data that, you know, that have to be analyzed in some way, and they have these statistics packages that some of the researchers use without having any understanding of statistics. So that's another potential pitfall. It's a very complex issue. That's why I like to stay at the level of the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm talking about brain plasticity, I'm not so focused on exactly what place in the brain is going to change when you do X, Y, Z. You can figure out whether, that if you put the time in, you get better at the things you try to learn. And, that's kind of, I would say, down-to-earth information.
We're in our last minute, Ginger, and I sometimes think it's appropriate just to let you summarize the things we want people to come away with. What are the important issues that perhaps you want to make sure people don't forget about where we are in these advances in understanding the mind and the brain?
Well, I think the more you understand about how your brain works, the more you understand what makes you the person you are. So I think it's worth for anyone, even if you don't really necessarily like science, to know the basics of, be suspicious of easy solutions, and look for opportunities to learn new things.
Well, listen, thanks very much for taking the time. I know you had had an all-night ER shift and night before you came on, so I know you're ready to go to bed, and I appreciate your taking the time and sharing all you do. And I got to tell my listeners that there's few better places to keep up to date on brain science than Brain Science Podcast, so thanks for doing that as well.
Thanks for having me on, Thad.
All right, have a good day.
Bye.
If you'd like to continue this conversation, you can join KSK on Facebook. Just go to www.alaska.org, where you can find this link. Next week, we're going to be discussing guidelines for screening for blood cancer in certain patients. These have now been published. We want to know who should be screened and how effective they are. So why not tune in next week to listen on KSKA. Pat Yak is Chief Contact Content Officer, Dave Waldron helped me with the engineering today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.